from the Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Systems, and Paul Frisch from the Oregon Medical Association. They are going to talk to us, and they have some very clever things to say about HIPAA. Some anacronym manipulations. But for those of you who didn't know, and I count myself among them, HIPAA stands for Health Insurance Portability Accountability Act. Did I get that out?
Did.
Good. I can leave. All right. Did my homework. Anyway, welcome. Thank you very much for being here. Enter and sign in, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and distinguished guests,
we are going to take you through a brief tour, hopefully make you smile a little bit. I'm going to do some pictures first. Gwen is going to do her presentation, and then tomorrow I will do another presentation, hopefully more on the light side than not. Mr. Chairman, that we should also let you know that the privacy rule is just a part of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It's part of the administrative subset, or acronym AS, and that is further evidence that we are delving into some areas that have potential for a lot of humor. What I'm going to do is take you on the same tour that I take my physicians and their medical office personnel. I had the good fortune of going into 13 physician offices around the state with a digital camera shortly after the HIPAA privacy regulations were first published, and my goal was really to try to help people understand on the ground what HIPAA was going to do and how it was going to affect their practices from both a privacy and a security of information standpoint. So join me now on a virtual tour of HIPAA. It was my promise to everyone that no patient would be identified, nor any staff person would be identified. The walk was always done in terms of a picture related to what I could actually see or reach out and touch. There was no attempt made on my part to delve into the far corners of an office or go places that a patient couldn't go. So you're seeing all this from a patient's perspective. Paris 2000, Oregon 2003. This is what HIPAA humor was as of 1999. It's a baby. Federal regulations prohibit our mentioning its race, age, or gender. And Representative Greenleaf, we did in fact have that sort of conversation today. People wonder, what does HIPAA really prevent us from doing? Well, let's take a quick look. First of all, this is an email that I received. And I'm going to skip that one because it got out of shape. But this is an example of a similar kind of problem. This is an this is an individual who says that they have tried to get records of their child's immunization records, vaccination records, and the office told them that due to some legislation that had been passed, the child would have to give authorization to the mother. What I mentioned to the committee... The other one is much more interesting, but unfortunately I can't show it. What I told the committee upstairs, the Judiciary Committee, a few minutes ago is my greatest fear is that come the 14th of April, we're going to have a problem with commerce of information flowing in this area. And what we really have to do is bring everybody up to speed, the citizens and all the people involved and affected. I'm afraid that the days of having the pictures of your patients posted without their authorization is gone. I also think this wonderful dentist who advertises every month in our local newspaper is no longer going to be able to post the names of his patients, thanking them for their service to him. So that'll all have to be by authorization. And signs like this, keep this door unlocked during working hours, probably have to change because the privacy rule anticipates that there will be some degree of security in the perimeter of physician offices. So look carefully for those signs, you HIPAA police. One of my favorites, just in case we need to get in fast, leave the key in the lock. And there it is. probably not going to make it as far as HIPAA goes, right? We're going to have to rethink that. But how far do we really have to go with this issue of locking things up? Let's take a little bit closer look. I took this picture not really realizing what was in it until I blew it up. We've got the physician in the corner, the medical assistants, and yikes, we have a patient with a door open. Does HIPAA say you can't have a door open? No, it doesn't, but it does represent a concern now about awareness of privacy matters and awareness of what needs to be done in order to protect patient privacy. Lying around this table, I can't really get my finger in there right, but lying around that workstation are a lot of papers. Are we going to have to lock them up? Probably not, but we probably are going to be asking people to turn things over so that inadvertent disclosures don't occur, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. This one is definitely, definitely, definitely a no-no. This is a list of the hepatitis C patients in the practice posted on a wall. Probably wasn't a good idea before HIPAA, most certainly is not a good idea after HIPAA. When you get back to the procedure area, check the list. If your name isn't posted there, maybe you shouldn't be in here this morning. This is a place that has five different procedure areas lined across the opposite wall. And when people wake up from their procedure, the very first thing they get to do is go over and read the names of everyone else who's going to be there today. Probably, again, not a HIPAA hero approach. Probably going to want to make that information, either cover it or make it somehow less visible. Now, this is really a reflection of what the cost of HIPAA could be. Most offices were designed to provide a great deal of service in a relatively small area. This is typical of many offices to have the x-rays in the wall along hallways where people walk. Does HIPAA say you can't do this? No. The privacy rule doesn't say you can't do this. What the privacy rule is concerned about is have you taken reasonable safeguards to assure that the information is not accessible to someone who shouldn't have access to it? If there's somebody in the area constantly watching over that, a desk is there, some sort of workstation, the likelihood that they're going to have to do more than that is not there. Just because a name is exposed doesn't make it a violation of HIPAA. HIPAA's rule says that inadvertent disclosure, as long as reasonable safeguards are taken, does not create a HIPAA violation, and Gwen will be talking more about that. There's another example. Reach out and touch someone's PHI. Do we have to block this all up and lock it? No, but you know, something probably is going to have to be done to make sure there's somebody there at all times in the area, making sure that people aren't flipping through there and looking at it. One question that comes up is, what about those allergy stickers on the outside of a file? What about the pictures of body parts and to reflect what has been done? In all likelihood, that kind of information coupled with a name would probably constitute the kind of protected health information that you'd want to avoid having readily accessible like that. Now, first of all, I want you to notice how neat this office was. They really take the record for neatness, but here is example after example of protected health information that is accessible. The reasonable safeguard would be to turn it over. There you see me shooting a picture into some glass, but I thought you'd appreciate the note. Fines will be inflicted on an as-needed basis. People were trying. Ah, one of my favorites. Members of the committee, is this a HIPAA violation? Under the final regs, no. This is not a HIPAA violation to have a person's name there. Probably where we get into difficulty in terms of reasonable safeguards is having any information about the patient next to the name. Now, here's what one practice does. And this is an adaptation that probably makes some sense. They put carbon paper underneath the upper one. People sign in. And then as the person signs in, they scratch the name off so it can't be seen above, but it's reflected below. But does anyone else see a problem with this slide? So look carefully. There's the weekly schedule with the name and why they're there. So we've solved one problem, but we need to solve the other. And on the return visit, what I suggested to them was they just simply put a cover over that information, lift it up when they need it, but keep it otherwise closed because that's exactly where people can look in.
Excuse me, Paul?
Yes.
Kelly, hit the lights, just a couple of the overheads.
It's hard to see.
No, that's actually pretty good, but this will make it better.
Okay. I just wanted you to know.
No, the other way, Kelly.
There's several switches.
I just hit a few of them.
Okay. I'm trying to move through this quickly, but not out of disrespect. I want Gwen to have time. The record storage here, one thing that one office does is it's using its limited storage space to secure the information by sliding things together and locking them. But also, this office, because it uses an electronic medical record, has substituted numbers for patient names on the sides. And that's a good adaptation. It's not inexpensive, though. This office has taken all of its reception, all the phone reception work out of the waiting area and put it into a back room. And I just want to tell you, the reason this is so successful is these people have never seen daylight in working in a medical office. So being near a window is a huge gain. This is very important. Under HIPAA, you have the right as a patient to inspect or examine your medical records. This arrangement works double duty. This is right now a business area where staff on the other side of the table serve those two patients. It could also be used for examination of records purposes. One person could sit back there while the patients examine their records, and there would be a sense of security, a sense of privacy. And I interviewed both those people, and they said they were not aware the other person was present. And so this could be an excellent, affordable adaptation to address this issue of people talking. I must tell you that under the privacy rule, it is not a violation of the privacy rule for information about care to be overheard. But if it's yelled out or any other way is broadcast over and above reasonable safeguards, it could be a problem. If your doctor's running late, just throw some x-rays up in the light box and keep yourself amused. This is an example of the dilemma that our clinicians face, which is there's a doctor at the far end of that hall working at a place where there's a telephone and a place where he can look at the chart. The exam rooms are just opposite on the left, and he is really making good use of his time. Whoops. Unfortunately, it's a little like failing to put the toilet seat down again, because as he left there, he left the chart lying out where I could look at it right by the telephone, and so we probably need to help him remember that. But from a clinician's perspective and a cost perspective, making the following kinds of adaptations could be difficult. Now, these may not be as such HIPAA violations, but you can see a perfectly good workspace has now been to some degree compromised by the fact that having to make this information less accessible to you and me walking down the hall could add cost. It certainly is going to add some time, and it's certainly going to be inconvenient. HIPAA says that things like screensavers are very important, but this is an old-style computer terminal. Just to let you know, when those terminals are left up like that, protected health information could be disclosed. Reasonable safeguard would be to reach underneath and darken the screen so that no one could see it. If you have a Windows-based program, getting the screensaver and login and password to come up is an essential part of HIPAA, and people are going to have to do that. Make yourself at home while we draw your blood and check out the schedule of people that are going to have their test done. By the way, there is a place that even to this day, outside at 5 o'clock, leaves all of their laboratory specimens for the pickup outside on the door, outside physically, in a clear plastic bag, so you can just walk right over and find out who had what test when. That would clearly not be a reasonable safeguard. That is clearly going to have to be addressed under HIPAA. This is a good situation. If you're going to have your blood drawn, there's the place you have it drawn. The circled area is where the protected health information, that's really good. Notice in the corner way over here, there's a little bit of a frame. That's going to come up in a second. This used to be a funny slide. It's not anymore, perhaps, depending on your perspective. But those are nicely color-coded. They're clear. Everything's neat. But I don't think the HIPAA police are going to be too happy about that. On those notes is some very crucial information about mental health status of one individual and about drug and alcohol treatment of another. And that's probably going to have to be turned around. And that's the work. That's the solution, the workaround. Now, this is the dreaded urine sample. I finally got one on 13 visits. I immediately go into the bathroom when I leave the waiting area, open the door, and there it is, the urine sample with the patient's name and information on it. It's on the other side of the area where you saw the chair in the laboratory. The person drawing the blood didn't have time to get in there. The problem with this is it's accessible to the waiting area, so anybody coming in would have an opportunity to see this, and that would be technically a violation of HIPAA. So offices are going to have to spend money and effort to make sure that stuff like this, that ordinarily would not have been perceived as a potential problem, they're going to have to address it. This is an important piece of information. What you see here is an advice nurse, a crucial part of the delivery of healthcare. That person is on the phone 6 hours a day. She's got her computer screen there, and guess what? I'm walking right past her in order to turn right to go into this office. Two things that are a problem here. I can see her, and I can hear her. Everything she tells to every patient, that's not a reasonable safeguard. That one would have to change. So I've given you kind of an overview of the spectrum of possible changes that would occur. This is definitely one where she's going to have to relocate. One of my favorites, if sticky notes are for anything, they're for putting your password and login up on the computer. You know, we don't want to forget about that. Workaround on that is probably worst case scenario. If they can't remember, stick it under the keyboard. We're encouraging everyone to put a sticker on their outgoing records, reminding them that patient protected health information is in the works. This is page one of a certain number of pages. And the idea here is to give people a sense of awareness about the need to protect privacy. This has been very popular. 50,000 of them went out in the first printing. So we have a feeling we've hit upon something. What's wrong with this picture? Look at that highly sophisticated shredding device down below, and look at that equally highly sophisticated overflow device at the top. The problem with that is there's a lobby right there, and everybody passes through and gets to see that high-tech overflow box and anything that's in it. That's probably not a reasonable safeguard. All of you who've ever had your x-rays know that we just simply are very recycling conscious, and this is a cost-saving measure. Put those x-ray stickers on there. The problem is we're going to have to change the way we think about those. Those will probably have to be covered up. This happens to be just a regular x-ray that one orthopedic office passed along to the next patient. We did have a pumpkin decorating contest at the OMA, and someone had the temerity to express their views about HIPAA. This is 2001, the view of HIPAA. I'm sorry, it's going to be a few minutes. I'm afraid the doctor is being held accountable. And that's it for me on this one. Gwen?
Thanks, Paul.
Any questions for Paul?
Gwen is kindly free to answer all your questions.
Oh,
I'm just kidding.
Representative Anderson, direct
the question. Mr. Chairman, what's the budget for enforcement on this?
The Bush administration's budget shows $10 million, and this was released 2 weeks ago. Our sense from talking to the people that are there is that they are going to work on a get-a-complaint-respond basis. So it's when your patient or your colleague rats on you that you're going to have the problem.
Well, I spent 30 years trying to deal with confidentiality issues, both at research and healthcare. And I'd like you to, I mean, all the things you said, and you said them in a kind of funny way, are all things that we've been trying to tell medical personnel and front office staff for 30 years. Is there anything here that HIPAA is enforcing that you wouldn't have told somebody, you wouldn't have turned their office in 20 years ago and said, common courtesy, common medical practice says, do this, do it right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleg, let me be very clear with you. Absolutely not. And in my judgment, the kinds of things that I showed you humorously are really not epidemic problems here. I think that the vast majority of people that provide services in this state do so both compassionately and appropriately. And I don't see HIPAA in Oregon really doing much to change what we already know. There are other states where there was really literally no floor on confidentiality. What HIPAA does, and we've said this already today, is it creates that floor. But I'm very proud of the clinicians and hospitals and other healthcare organizations and individuals. I think, by and large, we got the message long ago. And in my view, if we didn't have HIPAA, Oregon things would not have to change dramatically in order for us to be at and well above where HIPAA is. Does that answer your question? I'd like my colleague to have a chance to talk to you.
Well, I'd just like to say that based on, I take some exception with your last remark. I mean, based on the physician that this committee spends the most time with, I think the federal government finally got it right. I mean, I am absolutely, I cannot applaud the Bush administration strongly enough.
So all $10 million.
Mr. Chair, I have in my possession the medical records of a certain chairman, which we posted on the internet.
You have
it
until April 14th to make the decision.
Yeah, some of the medications involved are quite illuminating. I really feel for his wife. Mr. I do have a question, though. And this is, I suppose, I think basically most of us have looked at this and said, I'm doing all these things anyway. And I think it'd be very minimal changes for most doctors' offices. How do you deal with a situation in which, and this is a real one, I used to be chief of medicine for 4 years, and this is something that happens rather frequently, an employee at a hospital or a doctor's office will get into another employee's medical records. And you can't stop that from happening. What safeguards you put in?
When we put out,
you're not to be doing that ever, but it happens, and they do it on purpose, and they get caught at it. Is the employer responsible, or is the employee responsible?
It's an excellent question. Go ahead.
Well, this is Gwen Dayton. In my opinion, probably both. I think the employer, let's say, make the employer a hospital. If the employer has not adequately trained its staff on the minimum necessity requirement, which is essentially what Paul was talking with you about today, and their own obligations under HIPAA, then the employer is going to be liable for HIPAA violation, as well as the employee, assuming the employee is a covered entity under HIPAA, and I'm assuming that they are, perhaps a nurse or another provider. So it could be both. It depends on how conscientious the employer has been in making sure the employees know what they're supposed to be doing.
You're going to have policies and procedures, written policies and procedures as required by HIPAA under the privacy rule. In those policies and procedures, you'll have the statement about minimum necessary, and in all likelihood, there should be a statement in there to the effect that a knowing violation and a violation of the minimum necessary rule could be grounds for discipline and termination. And it would certainly seem to me, without that being there and without acting upon it, there is some potential exposure for the employee.
Any other questions for Paul?
The Prozac is over right by the coffee.
You say that right before I begin?
Yes.
Gwen,
I will
go
begin,
ahead.
And my intention is not to go through every word of this because I know that you all have lives and want to go home.
No, we don't.
Oh, you don't? Well, actually, the HIPAA's kind of sucked away my life.
Key phrase is all of you. Some of us do. Your key phrase is all of you, I think you said.
Yeah, I was too
he
broad.
Said no. Some of us do.
Well, to be considerate to those of you who do have a life, I will not go over every portion of this. I hope you will use this as a resource as necessary. What I'm going to do is do a very, very quick and dirty overview of what the HIPAA privacy regulations are. These are the regulations in the commentary. So you'll note that my three-minute overview is hitting the highlights. First, I'll just note that the privacy regulations are really just one part of the HIPAA regulations that are affecting healthcare providers as well as health plans and clearinghouses today. There are the transaction standards that require use of uniform forms and transaction standards. That's actually kind of the HIPAA good news. It's a huge pain right now, frankly. Everybody's coming into compliance. But once everybody is, we'll all be on the same page and using the same forms and identifiers, and it will save money, and that's a good thing. The security regulations were supposed to have been out about a year and a half ago. They're now promising them this Thursday that are in the regulations that tell hospitals and other providers and health plans what security mechanisms they have to have in place to essentially comply with the privacy regulations. So, but on to the privacy regulations, which are the topic today. The guts of the HIPAA privacy regulations are getting appropriate patient permission, dealing with minimum necessity, as Paul illustrated, and granting the patient the rights that are given to them under bottom line, in a hospital, which is my perspective, providers can release information for purposes of treatment, payment, healthcare operations without express patient permission. They are, however, subject to the minimum necessity requirement, except between providers for treatment purposes. Physicians can talk to each other about a patient, their treatment of that patient, without consideration of the minimum necessity requirement. But if they're talking about the treatment of that patient in the elevator, where there is another person present who is not a provider who's treating that patient, they have to worry about exposing more information to that person than is allowed. The minimum necessity requirement basically says you cannot disclose more information than is necessary for the purpose of the disclosure. So that's what Paul was getting at. You can't have information out where other patients might see it, where guests in the hospital, visitors, might see it inappropriately. So that's a lot of the day-to-day rigor of complying with HIPAA. Patients have very distinct rights under HIPAA. They have the right to receive a notice of your privacy practices when they show up for services. They have a right to access what's called their designated record set, which is a very broad definition of their medical record. They have the right to request an amendment of their record if they think that it is incorrect in some manner. They have the right to request an accounting of all disclosures. Most disclosures of the medical record. There are a number of exceptions, but they have the right to request an accounting of disclosures. Representative Bates, you raised an interesting issue. If you have an inappropriate access within, let's say, the hospital by an employee, they're snooping. They're just their neighbors in the hospital, and they think, I always thought this guy had something wrong with him. Let's go find out what it is. Well, there are those, and I am among them, who believe that is a disclosure that you must account for to the patient if they ask. You must say, Nurse Snoopy saw your record. Unless it's just an incidental disclosure on her way to somebody else's record, she wasn't trying to access it, she happened to see it, she moved on quickly, that's not a problem. But that overt attempt to access somebody's record that they have no business accessing is a problem and needs to be reported to the patient. Okay. What I'm going to do is take you on a tour of the hospital. Mr. Smith is going to the hospital. Now, the hospital itself would not be able to tell you, as Representative Green had pointed out, that Mr. Smith is in the hospital. I am not a covered entity. I can tell you that Mr. Smith has gone to the hospital. So he arrives. There's been an automobile accident, and he arrives at the hospital. He's on his own two feet at this point. Mr. Smith kind of morphs throughout. So he comes into patient admitting. Okay. It's after April 14. What is patient admitting to? They give Mr. Smith a notice of privacy practices. They can't just make it available to him. They have to put it in his hot little hands. Now, what if Mr. Smith speaks Spanish? The hospital has an obligation to provide a translation or an oral interpretation of that document for Mr. Smith, right then and there. They also need to make a good faith effort to have Mr. Smith acknowledge that he received that. Somebody in the hospital has to plug into the computer screen that they gave this to Mr. Smith. Because if they later change their notice, they have to be able to make that change notice available to Mr. Smith. So the hospitals are bending over backwards right now to adapt their computer systems to HIPAA. So there are fields on their computer screen. You can tell I'm not a computer person. That they can enter all of this information. They've done all these things. Now, Mr. Smith is now waiting to be seen. Can the admitting person say, Mr. Smith, we're ready for you? Yeah, that's a disclosure of identifiable health information, isn't it? Because they said his name and he's in the hospital. I mean, you're also in the waiting room. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that, you know, this Mr. Smith is here for treatment. But it is an incidental, disclosure that HIPAA allows. But if the personnel called out, Mr. Smith, we're ready for your colonoscopy now, that's a problem. And that actually happened to a senior official with the Office for Civil Rights. The Office for Civil Rights is the enforcing agency. They were in there, I think it was a physician office actually, but it could well have been a hospital. I mean, we're all, struggling with this. And he was sitting there with a bunch of other people, and they called out that they were, in fact, ready for his colonoscopy. And he indicated that would not have been an acceptable practice on April 14th. So, what else do they have to do in admitting? They have to worry about the minimum necessity requirement, not only the example I gave, calling out somebody's name, but Mr. Smith goes up to sign in. They can't leave the sign out sheets out there. They can't be talking to Mr. Smith in a voice that is so loud that everyone else can hear. They don't have to have soundproof rooms. but they have to be discreet and at least recognize they have this obligation. Now, Mr. Smith also has a number of different rights. He has the right to restrict, ask you to restrict release of his information. Hospitals and providers don't have to accept these restrictions, but once they do, they have to abide by them. Patient admitting is going to be the most common place where a patient says, I don't want you to release this information to this insurance company, to my Aunt Mary, whatever it might be. Most hospitals right now have the perspective that they will not accept those restrictions because they don't know if they can do it. They'll accept confidentiality restrictions like don't talk to my spouse. You know, if somebody's in for a sensitive issue, certainly will do that. But if somebody doesn't want it to go out, let's say in my example in your document, to the health division pursuant to the reporting that all hospitals are required to do, hospitals aren't sure they can pull that little tidbit out of their reporting and not provide it. So they may well say no. But Mr. Smith has the opportunity to ask. Patient admitting is also where the phone calls come in. Can you tell me my neighbor Joe or Mr. Smith is in the hospital? How's he doing? Well, they can give that information out in some circumstances, but not in many others. They can only give out basic information, condition, location. Mr. Smith is, not that he has a broken leg, but that he's fair, is critical, whatever he is. One word condition that doesn't talk about any kind of underlying diagnosis or other nature of his injuries. And they can say where he is in the hospital. If Mr. Smith has had the opportunity to say no to these disclosures, if he hasn't had that opportunity to say no, then it's up to the physician to make that judgment, which can often be very difficult to do.
So, Gwen, somebody's in a car wreck, they come in a coma.
Yeah.
According to the rules, unless they might not, somebody calls and says, is Mr. Smith in the hospital and he hadn't had a chance to make a determination, they can't tell him that.
We're going to the emergency room next, but I'll do okay. That now. Because I want to make sure we... do as much as we can do. Essentially, you are correct. If there's been no opportunity to put opt out, which is the term we use, then information can be released if the physician determines that it is either in the patient's best interest or consistent with his or her prior expressed wishes. From the hospital perspective, we're unsure if the hospital and physicians can really make that judgment. In the case of an anonymous Mr. Smith who comes in a car crash, they don't know him from anybody. They don't know what's in his best interest. They don't know who this neighbor person really is or what that person's interest is. And so I think typically in that circumstance, information will not be released, which is a problem on some levels. And let's talk about the media, since we're talking about that. The media also will be calling patient admitting or at a minimum the PR department. Let's say Mr. Smith is brought in as part of a big multi-car crash on the freeway, and it's newsworthy. They want to know, who do you got here? The hospital answers that question with federal privacy regulations do not permit me to give you any information. And the only way a reporter is going to get information in that circumstance is, one, they have to know the patient's name. They have to know you have Mr. Smith, not just somebody who didn't look so good in the ambulance. Okay? And then Mr. Smith has to have had an opportunity to opt out. If Mr. Smith is in a coma, even if they know his name, if the hospital or the physician can't make the judgment what's in Mr. Smith's best interest, they're not going to give the information. So the media is not very happy about that.
They can't look for Mrs. Smith.
The media can look for Mrs. Smith.
No,
sure. Sure they can. You can use family resources to determine what's in the best interest of Mr. Smith. And it may be that harassment of family members by the media to get information, I don't mean that. Legitimate questions as well, I don't mean to be harsh, are a good enough reason. The family may say, look, you know, we really want you to give this out. My husband really wants you to give it out because it's too burdensome on the family to be taking all these questions. I mean, that may factor into the decision. It certainly may. So, but there's a real education process that's going on now in the media community on what they can get.
Did you have a follow-up, Mr. Cruz?
Oh, you're running the show? Okay, fine. I figured with wrestling on, we could just do whatever we wanted. You got the hammer. Okay, good enough. Okay, let's say Mr. Smith comes in, he's in a coma. How would you go about finding out, for example, you know, without disclosing anything, who his primary care physician is, things like that? I mean, because clearly that's a decision matrix there, and
you are allowed to talk to family members who are involved in the person's care as necessary to facilitate that care. So if Mr. Smith comes in and wife is with him and you don't know who's been treating this person, you can say, Mrs. Smith, obviously she knows about her husband's
care. Right.
Who's the doctor? Who do we contact?
But if Mrs. Smith isn't there, you're kind of stuck.
HIPAA is not intended to interfere with the proper administration of good quality health care. And I think if...
Of course it's not. That doesn't mean it doesn't. But anyway.
Yeah, but you're exactly right. I think, though, if a hospital called me on the phone saying, we got Mr. Smith here and we don't know what to do, there's nobody with him, we don't know who to call, then I'd say, you find out. You know, whatever you need to do to find out.
Yeah.
If it means making some calls, you make some calls. I don't think you would be penalized for doing that. It doesn't make any difference on if Mr. Smith happens to be a famous person on any of these releases. He can be famous or infamous or any above, and he has the same privacy rights as anybody else. And that's also a relatively new concept when it comes to releases of information to the media. Now, let's say you come in the ambulance this time. You got this notice of privacy practices in your hand. Well, he's on the stretcher. You can't give it to Mr. Smith. There is an emergency exception. You don't have to try to give that thing to this poor guy. You can give it to him later when he's able to receive it. But you have to have a system to make sure that happens. The hospital can't drop the ball. When Mr. Smith is in recovery, somebody has to know. We need to give him the notice. We've got to go in and give him that notice. The other thing that I didn't mention that we have to do, all providers, is post the privacy notice in a clear and conspicuous place. Privacy notice tend to be 9 to 10 pages long because HIPAA is very expressed what must be in them. You can't just say you've got some privacy rights, contact a privacy officer. It has to be very detailed. And hospitals right now are literally ordering some big frames. And they're posting that thing on the wall because that's what they're required to do. So minimum necessity in the emergency room. You know, it's chaos in there. And HIPAA doesn't expect that you have some soundproof rooms for people that are in the ER. You do what you need to do to treat them, be discreet, don't be overly loud, don't say things you don't need to say, be understanding of who else might be there who's hearing what you're saying. That's really all that means. Law enforcement, I'll just speak on to briefly, even though I have fairly lengthy materials in here. Law enforcement typically comes to the ER to get information, and there are changes in what law enforcement is going to be able to get. HIPAA expresses very specifically that you can get this information about a victim, this information about a potential suspect. Hospitals can release certain information and not other information. For example, they can release suspicious wounds. If the police call and say, you got a guy with a bullet wound in the thigh because we think that you can say that kind of thing, but you can't say other things. And so the ER is going to have to be very well trained in what to do because it's never a calm situation when the law enforcement comes in and asks for information. And we've done some very express work on blood alcohol level and how you can communicate that to law enforcement. So that's a common source of request. And we've kind of wiggled our way through state and federal law to find some ways to provide information. Like we think in some circumstances you can give the blood sample but not the test result. You can say, here, Mr. Law Enforcement Person, yeah, they have to know that you've got this patient here, but you can give them a sample, then they can go test it themselves. You can't give them the blood, the test result itself, without patient authorization, because it's not for treatment, payment, health care operation.
Well, yeah.
You have to get permission from the patient to give that blood out?
We don't think so, because
you can get the blood out, but not the result. You don't think you have to have permission?
Yeah, that's what we've crafted, and it's a little dicey because the blood itself is not protected health information because it doesn't identify anybody. It's just a substance. It's when you put identifiers on it that it becomes protected.
How many angels on the head?
Well, see, yeah, you can decide whether that's a risky one.
If I may, just for a second, this brings to this group a very real problem, and that is HIPAA says that if it's required by law, that disclosure can be made without authorization when it would otherwise have to be. If we change Oregon law from may disclose to the police that blood alcohol information to shall, then you've accomplished a HIPAA goal, but you've changed public policy. And that may not be where public policy is going. That's an example of the kind of dilemmas that we are confronting with you and the Senate Bill 104 committee was trying to confront.
Right. Well, yeah, should we make the disclosure mandatory and therefore require it? Or should we clarify, as the amendments to the bill currently do, that you have to get some kind of patient authorization to release this blood alcohol level of 2.0? Unlikely. But Mr. Smith, if Mr. Smith makes Mr. Smith a person who is allegedly driving under the influence, he tries to leave the hospital and get in his car to go home, and he still is not exactly worn off the effects. Can you say anything? Yes, because HIPAA, there's a state law that allows it. That state law is not preempted because HIPAA expressly allows disclosures of protected health information as necessary to avert a serious threat to health and safety. So if this person is going to go get in their car and potentially hurt someone, you call law enforcement. But that's the kind of work that hospitals are doing, is understanding what you can and you cannot do. And it's, there's a lot of training involved in that.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of stuck on blood alcohol for just a moment here. A cop stops somebody who clearly is under the influence, refuses breathalyzer, all that stuff, and their last recourse is you know, blood alcohol, which they might want to do for other substances anyway. How would they proceed?
Well, if you're out on the street and you've arrested the guy and he refuses the blood alcohol, then you have the choice to arrest or not arrest. But let's assume that the person's in the hospital, right?
Well, I mean, a police officer is not going to take a blood sample. He's going to have to take this person somewhere to get the blood sample. Does he run afoul of HIPAA under those circumstances when he's going to make an arrest and he just needs to get documentation that the blood alcohol is X?
Setting aside the issues of whether you can put somebody who is under arrest in your police car and take him to the hospital for a blood alcohol test, just setting that aside, but let's say you walk in the ER, law enforcement with this guy in tow, saying, I want you to test this guy.
Right.
I think, well, hospital doesn't have to do that. They can take the blood sample and hand it to you. That's what we were talking about before.
Okay.
It's a little dicey. It's a little dicey. It's really drawing a fine line.
Okay. I know. That's why I'm confused.
Hey, Sarah, yeah. I'm back in the ER. I think you're confused.
I won't spend a lot of time in the patient room in the nurse's station because that deals largely with the minimum necessity requirement that Paul very ably demonstrated with his pictures. You just have to be discreet. That's really what it comes down to. You have to be aware of who the visitors are. You have to be aware of your volunteers, the candy stripers, the people that deliver flowers. They all have to be aware of the confidentiality requirements. And you also have to be aware that if a person opts out, they get their notice and they don't want any of these, they don't want their condition and location information released. That means no flowers get delivered, right? Right? That means you've got no visitors. Because that's disclosing location. And so that's the challenge, is to make sure patients understand that their concern for their privacy has some ramifications. Discussion between healthcare providers. HIPAA recognizes that physicians and other providers need to talk. And they need to be able to disclose information about the treatment of a patient. And so the regulations are pretty, they allow pretty free flow of information about treatment among providers. There is no minimum necessity requirement that applies, as I indicated. So that kind of consultation can go on back and forth. We talked about the elevator situation. What about ambulance services delivering Smith? Is the ambulance permitted to report its treatment of Smith? Yes, because that's between provider to provider. And that's allowed without any express permission because it's for treatment, and they don't have to worry about minimum necessity because it's between providers for treatment purposes. So that's how all of this is playing out. Or the hospital's calling the nursing home because they want to discharge Mr. Smith now to the nursing home. Can they call and say, we have Mr. Smith who has this XYZ condition and these care needs, do you have a place for him? Yes, because that is a communication between providers for Mr. Smith's treatment purposes. So it's important, we're speaking from the provider perspective, it's important for providers to think about why they're releasing information. Because in most circumstances, it's going to be for treatment or for payment or for what are called healthcare operations, which are essentially hospital management, quality assurance, peer review, utilization review, financial audit, attorneys, what it takes to make the hospital or physician office function. So that's the vast majority of the releases, and those can be done without any express permission. But there are some releases that very definitely require permission, and marketing is one of them that I put down. Mr. Smith has now been discharged. And the hospital wants to sell their patient list to a pharmaceutical company because the pharmaceutical company wants to, wants to barf it. They want to contact all these people with XYZ condition and say, you really could benefit by using our product. Can they do that? No. Not without Mr. Smith's very direct authorization. And in fact, if a hospital were to do something like that without Smith's authorization, they would be committing the highest form of HIPAA violation. They would be selling patient information. They would be subject to criminal penalties and enforcement. So that is an area where hospitals are working very hard to make sure they know what is marketing and what is not. Because, of course, the definition of marketing in HIPAA is a little bit squishy, and there are lots of exceptions. If your intent using the protected health information is to convince Mr. Smith to purchase a product, clearly that's marketing. But hospitals and others can talk to their patients about their services. They can say, hey, we're having a health fair this Saturday. We know that you smoke. You ought to come because we're going to help you quit smoking. That's fine. They can...
you're not splitting hairs, my God.
I'm talking to you, Bruce.
I don't take offense anymore. Everybody wants me to quit, and I haven't.
H286.
They can engage in what's called disease management, where if they know they have a certain population that has a high glucose level and they either have diabetes or are at risk for it, they can send out information to those people to encourage them to manage their condition. You can do that. So they just have to make sure, and I've given discussion talks like this on much more expansive on marketing where I get these very same questions going, well, gee, when have we really stepped over the line? And my response is, if you're concerned you've stepped over the line, then you get authorization. If it's that close to the line, then don't take the risk. It's not worth it.
So. Yeah,
Representative Cruz.
So you are making some baseline assumptions. Some things clearly you'd have to get Mr. Smith's permission to release his name to a pharmaceutical manufacturer, but you're assuming you don't have to get his permission to release his name to Quit Smoke Helpline. Is that?
If Quit Smoke Helpline is part of your hospital disease management, that you are using them, you're using that entity to assist Mr. Smith with his smoking issues.
Okay. But you're assuming there that Mr. Smith wants to quit, and if he doesn't, you're trying to market something that he's not interested in. So.
And you didn't get his permission.
I can understand.
If the helpline is calling him saying, "Hey, come to our class. It only costs $25. It's a great service." Because that is marketing the helpline. If it's more like a class offered by the hospital to encourage people to manage their disease, that's okay. Did you want to add?
No.
It's a fine line.
Okay. It's a very fine line.
Mm-hmm. It can be.
Can I follow on that a moment?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, there are privacy issues because... Representative Cruz has told his wife that he doesn't smoke anymore, that he quit a year ago. And now a postcard comes and says, we noted at your last visit that you're smoking, and we want you to think about quitting smoking. I mean, there are real privacy issues even in that kind of communication. Is
there not? Yes, there are, and that raises the minimum necessity issue, because Mrs. Smith has no business knowing that Mr. Smith is now smoking. That's something that is not doesn't further the purpose of the disclosure. And so hospitals and others will need to think about when they send out these mailings, if not identifying them on the outside of the envelope about what they are, so that Mr. Smith, if somebody opens the mail, can then read it and not have Mr. Smith know from the label on the envelope what that's about. Good point.
Yeah, I follow. The big discussion in the National Academy of Science discussions on data, even that preceded the HIPAA discussion, was who owns this data. This HIPAA, and the argument in those days was the data is owned by the hospital. The hospital gathers it. Does HIPAA reverse that decision? Is this data owned by the patient and held in trust by the hospital, or does this data become the hospital's data?
I don't think it expressly changes anything, but it gives the patient much greater right to access their record than they may previously have had. The record is still held by the hospital, and it's the hospital's obligation to maintain its confidentiality. So to that extent, the hospital will be held accountable for that record, not the patient. So in that sense, the hospital still owns it. But the patient has the right to request access, and the grounds for denial are relatively slim.
I think philosophically what they were trying to do was give the patient more input into how that information is used, if not more access. So I think in the context of your question, we can say that HIPAA does imply the patient is more like a partner than they had been in the past. But they certainly don't have legal partnership rights in it. But they're getting closer. This is the first step.
And the hospital can still use it for anything that's not prohibited.
The hospital can use a patient's record for peer review. They can use it for healthcare operations like that, to work with a utilization review, yes, in the way that they always have. They are subject to minimum necessity, but assuming they're using it legitimately, then that's okay.
Thank you,
sir. Mr. Chair, just to say one other thing about it, and that is that probably the most contentious area has been the area of marketing, because so many interests were at stake and are at stake in terms of access to that information. And I think that the major ground for discipline, if you will, is going to be there. And it's going to involve the disclosure of that information to third-party organizations in the good faith belief that it was appropriate. But it is going to change dramatically the way information does, in fact, now flow through pharmaceutical manufacturers, to pharmacy benefit managers, and others. And I predict that it's going to be the area, the single biggest area of discipline and fining and all that stuff.
Yeah. Because as has been expressed, that's really where the patient will see a violation of his privacy rights. If he's getting mailers from people that he doesn't want to get mailers from, and then he doesn't want to have his information, that's how he's going to see an improper release, I think, almost more than any other area. Let's talk a little bit about patient rights, because we're already past time. Patient rights really are the third leg of the stool, I think, on HIPAA, permission and minimum necessity being the other. Mr. Smith has the right to ask to see his designated record set, which isn't just the medical record. It's the designated record set, which is all information used to make decisions about him, so it's about his treatment or his payment for services. So it's notes made about billing. It's source materials like x-rays. It's everything. So it's going to be important for hospitals and physicians, especially if the physician is part of a larger group, to figure out where that designated record set is. In a hospital, it's everywhere. It's not just in one neat little file. So that's what our folks are doing right now, is gathering that in, making sure they know where it is if somebody asks for it. And again, if Mr. Smith happens to speak Spanish as his primary language, the hospital or physician will need to translate the designated record set. And that's going to be a significant burden, especially for a physician who may have seen somebody for 20 years. That's quite a big record. So Mr. Smith has the right to amend his record if he thinks there's something inappropriate in it. And you have the ground the provider can deny that request if, in fact, there's nothing wrong with the record. But if it in fact legitimately is incorrect, then that can, it can be amended. Of course, hospital, the physician doesn't want to just erase anything. They want to put in the new information over the old so that anybody later treating this person can see what was previously thought to be the case about this person. Don't just simply delete it. The real world application of this one is problematic, because if you amend the record, you have to notify those people that Mr. Smith wants you to notify about the amendment, and anybody else that you sent that record to that either relied on it or foreseeably could have, to the detriment of the patient. So what that means is, when you're disclosing patient information, the hospital is going to have to track where it's going. Because if the patient later amends the record, they have to be able to notify those people. And that is going to be a significant burden. Because, as I'm going to talk about next, the patient has a right to ask for an accounting of disclosures. But there are significant exceptions to that accounting right. They don't get an accounting of disclosures for treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, which is 90% of what you might do. They don't get an accounting for disclosures made pursuant to their own authorization. or to him himself, or of what we, the facility directory information we've talked about, condition and location. So if you happen to talk to family and friends, you don't have to account for that disclosure. Essentially, what you have to account for, and I put a list in here that my internal HIPAA task force has put together, is all those disclosures that are required to make by law. The disclosures to DHS, the dog bite disclosure, you know, the to law enforcement except under certain circumstances, to the state crime lab, there's a number of them that you have to account for. And so when a hospital or physician discloses any of these, they have to be able to flag it and make sure their computer system puts it into an accounting if the patient ever asked for it. And hospitals now are getting that software up and running, because that's what it is. It's a software issue. You have to have some computerized system, otherwise you'll just never be able to do it. But in light of the obligation to let other people know about an amendment to a record, and there's no exceptions for treatment, payment, and health care operations. In fact, it is disclosures for treatment. That should be of the most concern. Then you're actually really going to have to track some of those disclosures as well for practical purposes so that you can later follow up on a request for amendment. That's the whirlwind tour of the hospital. Mr. Smith is feeling better. We're all feeling worse. But April 14th will come, and I think, frankly, that once we get this under our belt and move forward, that it'll become something that we can do. Right now, it's a behemoth.
Mr. Chair, tomorrow what I will do, with your permission, if you're still interested, is I will take you through a similar tour of the office, and you'll have a chance to tell me what the answers are. But more importantly, I'm going to bring you some of the matrices that we've developed. I'm going to let you take a look at a notice of privacy practices. We're going to take a look at some policies and procedures that were developed. We're going to look at them in three different languages. And we're also going to take a look at what is a business associate and how does that factor in. And we're also going to look at a matrix of what is minimum necessary, what can be disclosed by whom, to whom. And that will give you a sense of the enormity of the task for an office. Our members, we have 6,500 plus members. The vast majority of our members are 1 and 2 physician offices. Everybody's going to have to do this. We're also going to talk a little bit tomorrow about workforce training. I'm going to tell you what's involved. Everybody in the workforce has to be trained by April 14th. And we're going to see what the moment of that is. And then finally, one thought I'd like to leave you with. Gwen has referred on several occasions to this idea of limited English proficiency. And the physician will bear the cost of providing the translation of that chart or a person there to translate the notice of privacy practices if our forms, we have them in 3 languages, don't cover it. The dilemma that we have is that when we go to translation services, when our clinicians go to translation services, there is no maximum fee. And we found them in Portland as high as $200 an hour with a 1 hour minimum. Now, when we're talking about providing services to a population, a frail population, to a population that's economically disadvantaged, those kinds of numbers are significant. And my concern in all of this is that there's a terrible imbalance that exists in terms of what the clinician's duties and responsibilities are and what some of the people who are going to benefit from this legislation are going to be able to get away with. And I make no bones about that. I think it's a serious problem. And I really wish in some way we could address that, because that is going to affect the ability of people to care for people. And that is not something that HIPAA intended, but it's an unintended consequence, but it's something we need to address.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cruz.
Well, I was concerned about that, because I'm assuming things like safety net clinics are under the same rules. And so I'm wondering, we have a safety net clinic in Elgin, which is a long way from anywhere. You know, and they get somebody who only speaks Russian. What the hell do they do?
There are a couple, Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, yeah. AT&T has a service that's available by telephone, translating languages, but it is expensive. I also would tell you that there is, parallel to us, there is a group that is looking into how to qualify people who are translators. You may be aware of this group. They've been meeting. They're developing legislation to set minimum standards. The problem with the standards they may be setting is it means the person in the office who is
otherwise qualified to do that translation service can't, because legislatively we've limited the ability of people to do that, or that a family member who might want to may not meet the standard of that. So I would urge you to be aware that parallel to all this other stuff is some work being done by those who benefit that could in fact add more cost and limit access inadvertently. And I hope we're paying attention to that.
I hope we are too, but my sense is, are there things we can do legislatively in Oregon to mitigate some of the HIPAA requirements, or are they pretty much cast in stone?
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, HIPAA, the privacy regulations right now, I think, are cast in stone. They are a floor that we cannot go below. Oregon law, in some circumstances, is actually more protective of patient privacy than HIPAA, and those protections remain. But in terms of mitigating any of what we've talked about today, no, I don't think so, because any attempt to do that would be preempted.
Okay, Mr. I guess from the perspective of this state, I see HIPAA as a solution in search of a problem, but to a large degree. I guess one thing I would like to get out of, maybe not today, but a sense of the increased amount of administration, red tape, time that's going to be involved in this compliance.
Put in cost in there.
Yeah.
What's that going to cost our healthcare delivery system?
The costs have been quite significant, and of course there is no remuneration for the compliance effort.
Well, I understand that, but you know, healthcare system under stress now, my God, we're adding...
Well, yeah, taking away the stress factor.
Bottom line, do you have any back-of-the-envelope estimates as to what this is going to cost Oregon's healthcare delivery system?
We have the, Mr. Chair, we have the estimates that were given nationally, and I guess we can draw the percentage conclusion. The minimum and disputed were between $35 and $40 billion to implement, and there were upwards of $100 billion by those who were opposed. With a B. And so you can do the calculation. It's going to be an enormous number in Oregon.
So do the calculation. We're numerically challenged. I want to know what this is estimated to cost Oregon.
$4 billion.
There you go.
40?
1%. Yeah.
$4 billion?
Right. I said, no, I said $100 billion. Yeah, it would be $4 billion.
$4 billion.
At the upper end.
HIPAA.
It's not so much about what you physically have to do. It's all of the administrative time and the back-end building that comes. Yeah.
Computer software.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm not only numerically challenged, I have hearing problems. What is your OMA's estimate as to what this is going to cost Oregon's healthcare delivery system? I want it from you, not from you.
We don't know. We don't
know.
Give
me your estimate.
Well in excess of $100 million.
Oregon.
Yeah. When you add the hospitals and the safety nets and the physicians and everybody else.
Well in excess of $100 million.
That is incredible. Don't get me wrong, I'm not mad at you guys.
Yeah.
I think Representative Greenlick alluded to this, the answer to this question, in his comments with regard to the, you know, the debate over who owns this data. But where did this come from? I mean, okay, I know it came from the federal government. What's the motivation? What was the thinking? What's the history of this?
Chair, my sense of it, and I think Paul probably has a sense of it as well, too, is that it came from the electronic age. The ability to push a button and send somebody's information over the airwaves around the world, not just next door. And what I think is, it's a good idea that went a little far, that they took this concept, which is very legitimate, and broaden it to the extent that it certainly has some very good parts to it, but that it became very, very burdensome.
Mr. Chair, I think what we know is that the large clearinghouses initially were having difficulty, and large insurance companies, multi-state, were having difficulty being cost-effective, wanted to implement electronic changes, but there were a patchwork of laws for the various states relating to the information that was flowing, as well as how the information flowed, the content. The transaction and code set standards, which really started were the driver here, were designed to let the large insurers, multi-state insurers, be able to require that people give them the same information in every state, and that was not true. the privacy advocates became concerned when they saw that the button could send the information around, and so they said, if you're going to make it easier for these people to make a lot of money, you darn well better provide some protections. So it rose out of that discussion. We want more information to flow. Privacy advocates said, we're afraid that when it starts to flow, all sorts of bad things will happen. Congress was correct. In my opinion, Congress was correct to wonder about this. They probably were incorrect in that they wondered for so long that the time passed for them to do anything, so the executive branch acted with its rules. And Congress has been in a sort of a defensive mode ever since, kind of puzzling through the rules. They were widely distributed, widely commented upon, and I would say that for the most part, the focus has been not on the privacy side, but on the transactions and code set standards, the content of what's in a bill, how it travels, and then the security side. The privacy side is receiving more notice now that we're close to April, and a lot of people are starting to say, can we really make this happen? Can we do it financially? And this was at a time when we were flying high nationally. The economy was in good shape. People had a sense that, you know, this was going to be okay. But the reality is, oh, and the argument has always been made that in making information flow more effectively and be more similar, no matter where you are, you're going to save time, you're going to save money. But the problem was the startup costs in this thing have turned out to be enormous. And in a changing economy, that has gotten together and formed a great problem for everyone.
Yeah, if you could bring it back tomorrow when you come back and your discussion, I'd like to know, as you mentioned, some of Oregon's laws go beyond where we are here, so I'd like to hear a little bit about that. And if there's any intersection with how all these pieces play together into the health care costs of the Oregon Health Plan and that sort of thing. If anything can relate into that, that would be wonderful. Thank
very
you.
Well. Very well. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you guys. Is that a question? Any other questions?
By the wisdom of government.
Well, there's, you know, I know the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution does cause certain problems now and then. But
it's kind of like so often we see a problem in a microcosm over there, and then we create something massive and universal to solve a small problem, and that's basically what's happened here.
I would like to make a comment, and that's I'm glad you were here for a refresher course for our doctor, and I did write him that note. It said, actually, we have requests that you be reeducated. So,
one recommendation I would make to you as a cost-saving measure, if you want to save money on anesthesia services in both dentistry and in regular medicine, I simply would suggest we record the HIPAA regulations and substitute them for anesthesia. They will put anyone to sleep, a deep, deep sleep.
Hey, with less liability.
Well, yeah. And
seeing no other business come before the committee, we are adjourned.
You know, you got a list of those.